Welcome back into the Lads Talking Footy podcast. It's me, Jordan Tana, here with Sam Whitaker and Simon Anderson. And boys, I just went down to the New Zealand embassy and I got my passport revoked because they were like, hey, we know you're the only non-biased guy in the Lads Talking Footy. Nah, jokes. But they were like, well, Argentina 13 plus, you picked it on the nose. We'll take you back.
Yeah, we'll take you back. Well, and if you're watching this, they haven't quite taken it back. What they've done is they've said, you're not quite allowed to support the 15 no, men's game. So we're going to give you the sevens jersey, and you can wear that until we
I'm what's down from citizen?
A resident.
I'm a resident, yeah.
We'll give you that. At least you're
an immigrant.
Yeah. You're on a working visa.
Before we get on into the absolute mammoth that is the Rugby World Cup final, the International Rugby League, so just a little bit of accountability. I had Asako, Mulitalo and To'o all to score a try. That was boosted to $7, which was voided, unfortunately, because To'o didn't play. But if you threw that on a multi, that was pretty tasty there. Asako to score 16-plus points or more at $2.75. Yeah. He did that in the first half, I believe, which was good to see. And then the same game multi of Tomoko, Asako, and Niokora, all anytime try scorer, into the Kiwis 11.5 at $10. We dropped there just on the Tomoko leg, which was a shame.
Oof. And he was looking dangerous all game, so that is unfortunate. I went New Zealand 11-20, and thankfully, but not thankfully for my betting, they blew that out. So, yeah, unfortunate miss there.
Yeah, same. I went 21-30, and they blew that out too. I had 32-10 as my exact score, missed that, but I had also the minus 20.5 at $2.30 that came through.
Okay. Nice. Well, I mean, one thing that surely did blow out was the $2 shops on the Samoan flag sales. Oh, yeah. Because Eden Park was just packed with a sea of flags.
And we thought that was going to be like a 50-50 split, but no way.
Yeah.
Never underestimate the power of the Islander.
Nah, I couldn't agree more.
Islander support. So.
Yeah.
And the power of the Islander.
Yeah. Foolish. It'd be quite foolish to underestimate that.
So England, they take on Tonga this Sunday at 2:30 a.m. England won last weekend 22-18. I think both of you guys picked that on the nose.
Yeah, England
good
1-12. Yeah.
Coming this week though, I'm going to flip that and I'm going to say Tonga do bounce back in this one. I'm not sure if you guys want to give a quick prediction on that.
Yeah. So you've got England as the favourite again, $1.54, and Tonga as the underdog, $2.40, with the line sitting at +4.5. And yeah, I said last week that England would take that first game, but I think Tonga's talent is undeniable and they will build in this series. If not win the whole thing, they're going to at least answer back and get this game. So I'm actually going to join you and back Tonga 1-12 at $3.50.
Let's hold hands for a second, boys.
Oh, okay.
I'm coming in. I'm going to back you, boys. I think Tonga get this one done. Yeah, it was unfortunate for them not to get the win this one. So I think they're going to get this one done and the next one as well, JT as well, and win the series.
Okay.
Yeah, nice. It's always a good sign when all three of us put our heads together and agree on something.
A couple of brain cells combined.
Papua New Guinea, they also take on Fiji on Sunday at 6 p.m. But the Kiwis, they take on Australia Saturday at 10 p.m. and that is at Amy Park. Val Holmes has moved to the wing for the Kangaroos, while a pretty much unchanged lineup really for the Kiwis. Foran is going to start at 9 with Brown moved to the bench, but that late change happened prior to the last week. So that one stands there. But last year, the Kangaroos, they beat us 16-14 at the Rugby League World Cup in the semifinals. Ouch. We last beat them in 2018, 26-24. So don't read into that too much, though, because these aren't like common test matches that happen between us. But one thing to read into is the scores. The last four games between us have been separated by no more than 8 points. And this is Kiwi's team is an absolute beast this season. This game, though, will be interesting. It's a bit of a feeling out game because these are the top two teams competing in next week's final. So this is just a tournament hearsay game, which is obviously going to be played on November 4th. And I believe that is here. So it will be between these two teams the final next week. How this plays out is going to be very interesting. As for my prediction, I'm going to be leaning the way of the Kiwis. I do like the flow that we had in that game. I like the pairing of Dylan Brown and Hughes. I thought it was fantastic. Yep. Obviously, we have a little bit of a weakness there at hooker as opposed to the Kangaroos, which have an absolute beast. But the forward pack, I think, matches them quite well, and the edges are fantastic. Tomoko and Manu.
Yeah.
Manu, he was playing fucking shirtless. It was just, he didn't give a fuck what he was wearing. He was just running through people. And so, yeah, I'll be leaning towards the Kiwis in that one.
Yeah, and I agree with you because they looked very good, man. They were dominant most aspects of the game. Like, their tries came from pretty much everywhere, and you can kind of see that from the run meters as they had 2,024 run meters to 12,032 for Samoa and 12 line breaks to 1. So Their little quick hands to get it to the edges and skin them on the outsides was real evident in this game, and it was a real promising sign. And in terms of the questions we had at the hooker position, I thought Kieran Foran was real good. Yeah. I thought he came on, and I didn't really notice Brown too much, but when Foran was on, I noticed he was like really active and, you know, really trying to put pressure on the ruck and the block hole. So shout out to them. It's looking real good, man. If I can just take you to the odds for a second. Australia, $1.39. So they're the big favorites in Melbourne. New Zealand, $2.90 underdogs with the line sitting at +8.5. And because of what I saw from the Kiwis last week, I got to take that line first and foremost at $1.83. And also based on the last results that you brought up before, both games being decided within 2 points. So I think the Kiwis first and foremost can cover. But from what I saw last week, and maybe Kangaroos being the sort of on their high horse and might take this a little easier because it is a tournament game as opposed to a final, I can see the Kiwis actually doing the number on them here. So I'm not brave enough to say they'll go back to back and win both games, but I think the Kiwis will win this game. So I'm going to say head to head and also take that line at $1.83 +8.5.
Nice. Interesting. Yeah, you boys picked up on the same points, you know, like the forward pack, like Big Nels, Leota, Fisher Harris, they were fantastic. And then in the centers, Joey and Tomoko, just, workhorses. Just to go back to last week, we were wondering where Farmano Brown comes from. Did some research, and he plays for the Knights, right?
Yeah,
so we figured that one out in the middle of the week, so I'll just clear that up if anyone was wondering. But this week, I think, you know, we got a clean sheet and put a lot of points out wide on Samoa, and Australia is known well for their great defense. So I'm not predicting a lot of points come through the middle. So I've got a bit of a same game here. I'm picking basically a center and a winger from both teams. So I've got Staggs and Tomoko, and then Asako and Hamiso. Oh, Hamiso is on the wing or in the centers?
In the centers.
These are the centers this week. Yeah, so two centers and a winger there. So Katoni Stagg, Tomoko, Asako, and Tabuai Fido all to get down anytime for $41. And then get this one. This one's for you punters who are looking for a little bit of extra. I'm thinking it was – I've got Australia 13 plus here. That must have been an accident.
I was looking at
Australia 1-6. I think it's 1-5, sorry.
Okay.
And that's $6.50. So okay. I'm picking a close Australia win there. So get behind that one if you like.
Yeah, and just to go back to what you're saying about the middles, James Fisher-Harris and Nelson Asofa Solomona, they were absolutely outstanding and ran up the stats in limited minutes. Fisher Harris, 63 minutes, one try, 151 run meters, one line break, and 25 tackles. And Nelson, in even less minutes, just a half, 40 minutes, one try, 140 run meters, one line break, 8 tackle breaks, and 2 offloads. Beast, man.
When he came on, he was an absolute animal.
Straight away.
Straight away, just the line break straight through the middle. And it's not only the line breaks and the meters that he's getting for it, he's picking out a hooker or a half, and he's putting up the bumpers and he's trying to put a bump
evidence in that try as well.
And one thing before we go to you, the huckers beforehand, absolute fireworks, and that moment between Big Nelson and Spencer Lenu, when they just stared each other down for that long. It was like everyone had broke sides and they were still there. It was like, okay.
It was good.
These two are going to meet.
Yeah, I just hated at the end how they broke and like shook hands. I reckon they should have just held
respect.
I was like,
come
on. You're
not showing respect.
You're going to be fucking battering into each other in like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It'll make good content for when they face each other in the square ring. What I was going to say was it's so nice to have Nelson on your team. Like, I'm so used to just being like, oh fuck, just tackle the cunt. I'm so used to him terrorizing my team. So to have Nelson in the Kiwis is just so nice.
And it's good to like have that sort of size with him, Fisher Harris, and then Leota was there as well, right? Mm. So we've got big cannonballs that can match the physicality of the Australian big boys like Payne Haas and like all those other guys.
Tino as well.
Tino. Yeah. So this is the team that can do it. This is genuinely the team that can do it. I'm not just being a homer. We've got a great chance here.
Yeah, I agree. Especially when you've got Fisher Harris and Leota matching them, and then you bring Big Nelson in to do what he does. It's an absolute destructor. I've got two power players for me in this one. There's actually some juicy ones in there, but I'm going New Zealand to score 7+ points in each half, and that's at $3.50. And Asako, I'm jumping on that one again, to score 12+ points at $4.50 there as well. The NPC final, Taranaki, they defeated Hawke's Bay 22-19 to win this year's Bunnings NPC competition. We put all of our heads together and we all jumped on Hawke's Bay 1-12. Yeah. So we went down there. What were your guys' sort of takeaways from it? I thought, just in terms of the whole rugby competition to see the crowd in attendance and join that. And afterwards as well, they just paraded onto the field. It was really good to see that grassroots sort of feeling happening within the game.
But for sure.
Nonetheless, Taranaki had a fantastic season. They had a lot of superstars within. They played a really good game and then Hawke's Bay managed to chase up. And I was thinking, okay, here comes the momentum with that. But again, Taranaki just too good and managed to hold on.
And it's they were just more dangerous from everywhere. Like, they were the lethal attacking team. That Hawke's Bay was kind of, you know, controlling the game and controlling the areas, but they weren't playing with their usual, like, ferocity and, like, taking it out wide and trying to split them on the edges. Whereas Taranaki through Ratanumavtavuki Nimkins.
Yeah. Nice, yeah.
Did I get that?
Yeah, it's good, yeah.
You know, he was super dangerous. He's going to be a star for the Blues going forward. And, yeah, Taranaki, in front of their home fans, absolutely spectacular atmosphere. And you see the crowds during the season and it's kind of like, But when it gets to a moment like this where it's two non-franchise teams in the final and you get a turnout like that, that's what Bunnings NPC is all about. Because say if it was Auckland versus Canterbury for the 17th millionth time.
At Eden Park or something.
It would have been probably half packed. Feeling. Yeah. Yeah. So great environment. Great for Taranaki to get the win in front of their fans. And yeah, the Hawke's Bay are just going to have to stick with the shield to fucking do their lines off.
Yeah, I think you put it quite perfectly, JT, with the way they didn't stick to what they've had success with.
Yeah.
And we know, we've talked about it a bunch because it's finals footy everywhere for the last few weeks now, months, and that you've got to play a little bit more conservative, a bit more structured and take points when they're offered. But if a lot of your success is coming from adventurous play, then you've got to at least have the moments. You can't remove it completely. You've just got to be really careful about when you do it. And so I think that's what Hawke's Bay did, is they probably bought into the finals atmosphere and just, when you're not playing adventurous, it's not exciting and you're not fully in the game. You know, you're just, because it's not as, you know, as a player, you're just not as committed to that sort of tight style of play. But if you're throwing the ball around, you're far more likely to give your all for it. So I think that's what it looked like on the field, is Taranaki were just full 100% in there and Hawke's Bay just were trying to be in a final and not win a game of rugby.
And that definitely could be a factor. They could have been playing with some tight buttholes, because I looked back at the NPC finals going back to 2006 and Hawke's Bay has not been in that.
Yeah.
I know they were in the semis and they were pretty much undefeated like a couple years back, but they didn't make it to the big dance. They were thrown into the big dance in a hostile environment. Not hostile, but, you know, an away crowd with plenty of Taranaki supporters there. And, yeah, they kind of laid an egg.
It was a bit of a shame for Brad Webber. He missed out on that Super Rugby title with the Chiefs, and he was right there for the NPC title with the Magpies as well, which was a shame. But
Was he with them in, like, 2013, 2012?
Yeah, I believe he was. Okay. Yeah.
Too many rounds of golf.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought it up before, because I had a question for you guys. It's been spoken about a lot throughout the year, the slow death of rugby at the moment, and it's evident obviously through the crowd attendance in the NPC competition, so much so in the Super Rugby as well. The international will leave out of it because that's its own sort of thing, and it's actually a very prestigious thing and not something that's commonly done to go to an All Blacks game because it is so hard to get to. But I know I'm a catalyst for it this season, where I've been to almost every Warriors game this year and I didn't once go to a Blues game. I went to a few Harbour games throughout, but admittedly that is to just support a good friend, Tom Barham. But what is something that you, I guess, not would draw you in, but what is something that you think would help the actual NPC competition or Super Rugby competition start to sort of thrive again? I get the statistics sort of based, sort of being able to follow that and talk about a stat sort of orientated thing for the likes of us doing this kind of thing. But it is also hard when you're talking about rugby. It's not sort of a sport that features statistics quite big. One thing that's been spoken about a lot is they are going to be, I think, looking at introducing names on the back of jerseys moving forward. So there's something in terms of jersey sales and things like that, which is quite cool too.
Yep.
We all go to our Warriors games and the likes of that, and we throw on our Warriors jerseys or retro jerseys, which brings me to my next point and bringing back that grassroots sort of thing. Yep. You've got the super competition and super round in Melbourne, bringing in like a featured, you know, vintage jersey for all of that, and marketability, maybe sort of drawing that in. Maybe if I've got my retro jersey on and stuff like that, I'm going to pop down to Eden Park. But
now you said the key word. Basically, that's what I was going to touch on. They need to put more investment into the actual marketing of Super Rugby, and they need to market it a bit better than what they're doing it, because at the moment it's real like targeted for kids, and you're pretty much like whittling down your own, like the demographic to just kids. Whereas like adults, probably they watch it from afar and they watch it on TV, but they go, ah, I can't really be bothered going to a Harbour game or going to a Blues game. Yeah. I'll just watch it on TV.
Yeah.
Whereas if you can market it as this cool product by, you know, you say the stats aren't important, but it is important.
It is, yeah.
You get adult fans, your 18 to 30 year old demographic, going online and trying to see who is
what did Rico Ioane do in that
yeah,
game?
Yeah, exactly.
Know? And how many line breaks, how many run meters, yeah, and things like that, and just making it there.
Because, once you get past 18, I feel like every adult male gets a little bit autistic and they get real, like, they want to know exactly who's good and at what. Yeah. So I feel like they can do some better investment into that. They could also introduce a good fantasy aspect to it as well. Like, NRL is real popular because of how good their fantasy is. Like, I know people playing fantasy in NRL that don't even really watch the NRL. They're just sort of casual, but they're like, oh, I'll join in and I'll play this game where they can understand the values of the players and how good they are and whatnot. So bottom line is there needs to be better marketing for Super Rugby, for NPC, and then that'll just get involvement from more demographics than just your kids.
Mm, nice. I fully agree with what you've both said, but I think my angle, I mean, let's take you back to my childhood and the...
How long ago was that?
Oh, a few decades. But NPC, ITM Cup, whatever it was called back then, right? It was the level above Premier Club Rugby, right? And when you were following your provincial team, you knew those players from the clubs that they played for growing up. Or, you know, you at least had some close ties to the majority of the team. But now we see a lot of these NPC teams, they're not filled with a lot of players from within the region. And I think there needs to be a better job of linking these provincial teams to the clubs that these players are coming from. I mean, even if they are getting a few players from outside the region, swapping and finding a spot in a team, if you've got a good number of players who are from the region and have made it into the provincial team, you need to promote them through the marketing and get that these people who live nearby, because there's a difference between viewership and live match attendance. And I think you need both.
Yeah.
So I think the difference as well, and what's not helped, is the average age of a professional player has dropped significantly since we were watching rugby. Players are coming straight out of high school into Super Rugby competitions. And so this provincial level isn't as prioritized as a pathway to further success, right? You didn't really see many people when we were younger playing Blues rugby or Crusaders before they played Canterbury or Auckland or North Harbour. A lot of people made their way through the tiers, and now you're not seeing that pathway is so clear, and the talent are going straight to Super Rugby. And then because of the conflicting seasons and the way they've structured the international schedule and the provincial right after Super Rugby, the players just aren't interested in making that commitment. So I think that's an unfortunate factor, and I don't think we're going to fix that with the way that the professional players are just leaping straight into Super Rugby.
It is actually a good point that you've brought up in terms of the international timeline to NPC.
Yeah.
Because as a kid, it was always a luxury getting to go and watch a Harbour game and seeing, you know, Anthony Boric and Luke McAllister playing for All Blacks,
Rudy
playing
Wolf,
for North Harbour.
Tuivasa-Vaki. Yeah.
So maybe that is something that could be sort of, I know it's a tough balance in terms of obviously your Super Rugby finishes and the All Blacks go off and we have the Maori test matches and the All Blacks 15 and all these sort of things going on. But maybe kindling that or reducing that or just something in terms of altering the competition to actually introduce those All Blacks into it, because it's super beneficial for those players. I mean, Tom firsthand getting to play with the likes of Bryn Gatlin, Bryn Hall, and then you've got Mark Talia. He's training in the gym with a guy that's just been in an All Blacks camp. Like, it's pretty epic. And then,
well, I know he's our mate, but Shawnee Stevenson.
Exactly.
Yeah. Shawnee Stevens is a great club man, and that he could be playing for any team or not playing provincial rugby at all.
Yeah.
But he chooses to stick with North Harbour and has had fantastic success.
Could have stayed at Silverdale.
I mean, no, but that's a whole other conspiracy topic if we want to get into about the lack of selection from quality Silverdale rugby players in the North Harbour Union. But you know, if there's somewhere they could link your local club fees for juniors and stuff into discounted rates for live matches at NPC level or something.
That's a good point.
There is a huge pool of rugby fans at the junior level. Like Silverdale, our club, has one of the biggest pools of junior rugby, you know, and they don't all go to North Harbour games. So there's got to be a way of getting these people. And then it's well documented the fall off between junior rugby, the gap in high school, which is poorly managed, and then people not playing senior rugby. So, I mean, there's so much you can do in fostering that grassroots club level game of rugby that leads to more people in the seats of stadiums for provincial games.
If you're listening to this and you're an investor, there is a lot of room to work with right here. Yeah. You can introduce a lot of stuff.
I was just going to say that something that I liked that they did in terms of like a marketing aspect, more to your point in trying to grow it at a grassroots level, was taking it to the odd club game during the season.
I was just going to touch on that because I'd been to a couple that were at the likes of Takapuna and things like that. And it's good to bring that club from that region off playing in these certain clubs and stuff like that. And you get a lot of kids down there. And not only that, beforehand, you had the Bees playing as well as the opener. You had the girls playing in their competition as well. So you get all of them there and reconnecting with it. You pay a small fee, you go in there, you get a couple of beers, and you're just at your local club as well, which was cool to see. And then it is also they're playing in their club socks. So like you're at Takapuna and you've got a couple of boys wearing those Takapuna socks and stuff. And it is there. They just need to find how they just amp it up a little bit.
They need to
when it returns from the grassroots
promotion,
to a stadium.
For sure.
Yeah, promotion is the hugest one. And I think New Zealand rugby is a bit of a poor organization in itself in terms of the finances. Like they just can't dump the money they can't dump the money in like the NRL, because I mean, if you compare the promotion and the social media content and just the quality of the video content that plays on standard TV channels, NRL is just like the top tier of Southern Hemisphere competitions. I mean, you can't even look at Northern Hemisphere and the United States, because that is just a different beast in terms of the advertising they can.
Good point though, because you've just got the NRL, we've got a very lengthy international season, you've got Super Rugby, and then NPC on top of it in terms of just a 27 weeks ban. There's so much you can go on about.
Well, what you're basically saying is that NPC needs a Matt Nable.
I've got no idea who that is.
Oh, he's the guy who does the today, the Broncos take on the Warriors.
Yeah. We do need that.
Yeah, I'll put my hand up.
Get rid of Justin. I'm surprised at how long that took, because it is a burning question. It's something that's like, it's discussed about a little bit, but it's like just nothing ever seems to happen, and it will just be the same Super Rugby competition next year.
I'm a little bit more inclined to watch rugby league now, but I was brought up rugby union like to the death, so I don't want to see it die. And like watching the results of like the Wallabies and what we thought was going to happen with the All Blacks, and then they've totally turned around, which is great for them. But watching what's happening to Bunnings and stuff, it is kind of alarming.
Especially when you see the likes of the dollars being spent elsewhere. Yeah. You don't want those players to go. Yeah,
I mean, the writing's on the wall. There's NRL, but then there's also like basketball and these other sports that are just getting much more popular, even like combat sports in New Zealand. Yeah. So the attention span and the athlete pool within New Zealand is getting smaller for rugby, and we can't be having a poor promotion of our product.
Anyway,
yeah,
Rugby World Cup.
If I could,
the All Blacks, they defeated Argentina 44-6. I called a final score of 28-13. I was well off there. My best bets for that one, I had the All Blacks by 11-20 at $3.20, went down. Try scorers, I had Will Jordan at $1.65. Went in there, Cody Taylor at $2. Missed that one, but I also had Will Jordan for two or more tries at $3, which I was pretty happy about.
Yeah, and I had All Blacks 13+, so I'm happy that came through. And then in terms of a score, I think I went 38-19. So I gave Argentina maybe a little bit too much respect, and I didn't back the boys enough. So,
yeah, I was the same. I had 11-20, missed that, and my perfect score was 34-16. So I gave Argentina a little bit more than you, and paid the price.
Yeah,
nice. As for the game, though, Will Jordan obviously finishing absolutely fantastic. Three tries, and now one off actually breaking the record. He's tied it currently. If he scores again, which he should have in that one,
he
will break it. Oh, Richie.
Yeah. Richie's still holding on to Lomu, bro. He's like, that's my guy. That's the legend. I can't let you break it.
Well, Brian Habana he's been at the competition as well. He might have snuck in cheeky little, now, Argentina led the game in territory and possession statistics. They carried for more meters. They broke more tackles. They made the gain line more than us, and we're more effective in the tackles made than us as well. But we're still won by 38 points. For me, this makes it somewhat alarming in a way when I was looking at that coming into this week. But just the fact that we executed perfectly on everything that we needed to, the strikeout wide is outstanding.
Before you move on, I have a take on that because I was watching the game and Argentina tried to hold the ball to victory. Like they didn't offer much. It's like they watched the Italy game and saw Italy chance their arm and then just absolutely backfire. And they tried to go in their shell and just grind their way to a victory. So I wouldn't read too much into the territory.
I noticed when I was looking through them and I was seeing the heavy lean and then as opposed to the other and then looking at the scoreboard and it really came down to just execution from us was perfectly. And also the Malteser, Mark Talia, every time he touches the ball, it looks like he's breaking three tackles.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely exceptional. The pairing between him and Will Jordan is just fantastic.
Yep.
And if he commits to NZ Rugby moving forward and we have Will Jordan and then just whoever that next flyer is on the other wing, it's going to be deadly, that back three.
Yeah.
But one thing that I did like from Fozzie as well is bringing off the likes of Bowden Barrett, Aaron Smith, Sam Kane early
pretty
in
early.
That one
yep.
to keep them fresh for this week. Trust in Fozzie, man. He's doing well.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed from them in that one. A little bit of a shame from Argentina. They've never advanced, obviously, past the semi-final stage. I think they've made 3 World Cup semi-finals now. Just came up against the wrong team.
I'm going to be honest. They've overachieved to make 3 semi-finals. Like, if you compare them to Ireland.
Coming out of the pool. Yeah, there we go.
So, it's actually a success, in quotation marks, because they did lose in a very comfortable fashion, but they did still make the semis. And there's a young team, so there's stuff to work with there. And then they've got a gun sevens system coming up as well. So they'll be able to pick players from that and have a real go at the next World Cup. But in terms of this game, they didn't offer much. And I have to credit a lot of that to the All Blacks defense because, once again, we're outstanding. That's a couple games in a row now where we've actually shown great defense. And what do I always say, man? Defense wins championships. Not my saying at all.
You did
all,
also say Ireland were going to win.
I did, but you know, we forget about that.
Yeah, I've rattled him.
The dynamic kicking game as well, starting to work, blending short and long kicks, which was fantastic. Our kicking numbers, 1,004 kicking meters to 669. We're rolling at the moment. Like our momentum's real good. And if you compare it to the South African result, you got to be fucking happy with what you're seeing from the All Blacks.
The way that we control the kicking game is outstanding. Aaron Smith is usually pinpoint with his boxes. Richie Mwanga has just a bag of kicks with us in his arsenal in terms of the chip kick, the crossfield kick, and lining it up from wherever. But Bowden Barrett, for me, has controlled the counter-attack really well this year in terms of figuring out when to just place the ball or this little chip kick that he's bringing in a lot because he's kicking deep early, he's pushing them back, worried about the 50-22, and then they're just attacking that little chip kick every now and then. We saw Fyinga Nuku a couple of weeks ago in that one. Again, he had one in this game as well, and it's very, very smart the way that they're playing, and I was impressed again with the kicking game because England did well, which we'll come to in their kicking affair with South Africa. But if you can control the South Africans, it's going to be interesting to see what they do.
Yeah, I was just looking at the stats on defense, and I think you've got it on the nose there, JT, but 50 points conceded since we played France. So that's
damn.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah,
man.
And 24 of those, so half of those points came against Ireland. Right?
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've done fantastic. I just thought it was a little bit concerning that Argentina showed a fair amount of quit early on. It seemed like they just they saw the writing on the wall and they just didn't think they had they looked like they didn't have the belief that once they were a few scores behind on the board that they just couldn't overturn
that enough.
I mean, I think a lot of teams know that once the All Blacks have a lead, it's very difficult to get that back from them. And you know that any lead you have is pretty suspicious and could go away at any point. But I mean, Talia, just fantastic, over 100 meters carried with him. It's just so nice to have him in the squad, and just we've talked about it all through the Super Rugby season, the work rate and the ability to look for work and get involved is fantastic from him and from a winger. It's, you know, brings a tear to my eye. It's old school winger footy.
Slippery, man, around the ruck.
The center of gravity, the strength, the ability to shake players off and just carry for meters is just phenomenal.
Crazy and
small stature.
One thing I do want to point out in terms of the kicking, we were talking about it before, but goal kicking, are you worried about that at all? 4 out of 8?
We have those games, man.
Yeah.
He's had games a couple beforehand where he's kicking perfectly off the tee as well. So get your misses out of the way now, Richie, because,
okay.
And your passes. But
I'm going to be speaking as if I'm a kicker, but I'm not. But maybe you can attest to this more. Momentum in kicking is like kind of a good thing. I know like that Luke, I saw a clip about Luke McAllister, how he was feeling good. Yeah. Hopefully this doesn't carry over and isn't like a...
To me, Richie just seems like a confident guy. I wouldn't be worried about it being a mental thing. He's going to be prepared for the moment when he's out there. And he knows he's a gun kicker. And on the other side of that, and you got Jordy as well, where he's not going to be reliant on all of these...
good backup.
Having to take these penalty kicks when offer because you've just got an absolute sniper from 50 metres deep that's going to whack them over. So, yeah, I'm not too worried.
The other thing, though, I think we just need to get our first few minutes under control because it's been a few weeks now. We've delivered a quite passionate haka, and then there's been key players to have a real shaky start.
Aaron Smith, a couple passes
were pretty low or high. So I think, you know, it's good to have that moment of us building that energy inside us, but it can't be to our detriment. And we're playing against a side like South Africa who will want to start hot and will capitalize on us making mistakes if we're not completely focused on the game. So that's just one thing that, you know, the All Blacks are good enough to focus on. And I'm sure the leadership team will have picked up on that and make sure that they adjust that before this final. But yeah.
Oh, for sure. Now, South Africa, they defeated England in the 78th minute with a penalty to win 16-15. Unfortunately, I didn't watch the game. And when I saw the box score on the highlights from it, we just talked about the death of rugby. I didn't want to watch the game after that as well. When I'm just seeing penalty, drop kick. But I will say that is what I sort of thought was going to happen. I had England head-to-head at $4.80 and we just missed on that one. But I also took them on that spread of 13.5 in a semi-final. They are a good team. So we went in on that one. But England, again, they proved that, like you said, the defense from them, outstanding. But if they can turn a game into a controlled kicking orientation where they can bring in these penalty advantages, either take the penalty, slot the drop kick, do whatever, it might be ugly, but they're getting results done with it.
Yeah, and they really weaponized the high kick in this game. And that's something that I think you were going to bring up before about what we do good and what South Africa really struggled with in this game. Because I don't know if it caused it to snowball with all other mistakes in other areas of the field, but it started with the high kicks and that's what they were dropping first. And then they, you know, started dropping balls from, you know, pick and goes and stuff like that. And I was thinking, fuck, South Africa is actually really laying an egg here. And for them to still win this game,
which is why you saw, I know the South Africans do this weird stuff with the substitution bench, but to bring on Pollard as early as they did, they identified that and figured out that they need to get someone with his experience in his kicking game as well. Not just with the boot for goal, but just a little bit more
structure,
control to steady the ship because, it is weird what the South Africans do.
Yeah, the ship was slowly sinking, bro. It was a really bad performance, but that's what kind of worries me going into this game because they laid their egg and they still got it done. Like, and we know what South Africa is capable of. So I was really hoping they would kind of slip in this game, but you know, they got it done. Credit to them. They did that good line out drive. RG Snyman busts over all 6'20" of him.
Yeah.
So South Africa, man, that's a championship mentality and they showed why they are the reigning champions.
Yeah, just quickly, I picked South Africa 1-12 at $3, so that came through.
Oh, same here, yeah.
And
oh, no, I didn't. No, 11-20.
Yeah. So,
I picked South Africa.
This was a true Northern Hemisphere test match. Like, the territory and the kicking and penalties was just the focal point of the game. And full credit to England for applying an attacking process that South Africa were going to struggle with. I mean, if the game had been a lot more open and free-flowing, I'm sure that the ball carriers from South Africa would have allowed their backs to do a lot more damage. But that was one thing that it seemed like wasn't a strong feature, which when you look at the South Africa versus France game, South Africa were carrying the ball incredibly well, making a lot of meetings at the gain line. But England just managed to kind of shut that down and turned it into a territory battle, which South Africa aren't as skilled in doing. And I mean, we've seen Farrell knock over drop goals and things like that. So
that was a big one though.
Yeah, so it was classy, man. Yeah. Very classy from England. And it's a shame they couldn't get it done. I will just shout out. I mean, he probably won't get much of a shout out for it, but Benno Kiffey, bro.
He's had a good competition.
He had a really good game, and I mean, there was a bit of noise from salty English fan about that last scrum penalty, but he explains it really well about how the knee hit the ground first. I think it was the right call.
He's copped a lot of flack this year, right? After the super final as well.
He's like a double-edged sword in the way he refs. He likes to let stuff go and he likes to let stuff flow. And if you're on the wrong end of, say, like a missed call, I mean, he gets a whole bunch of shit. But I like his, I like the way he sort of looks at refereeing and how he tries to let it go.
Agreed. Now, Argentina, they take on England this Saturday at 8 a.m. for the third and fourth placing in this one. It is always a funny affair when this happens at a Rugby World Cup, when you just drop out at the semi-final trying to go for the big dance and then you got to play this third and fourth match. I did like what Argentina said afterwards. They're not done. They want to come home with the medal. It will be interesting to see how they go, though, because, look, I'm going to be picking England in this one because they're a little bit more physical. They know how to grind out a game. And after what I saw, what we did to Argentina in terms of what England can bring to this one, might not be pretty, but I feel like England are going to get the job done.
Okay, so you got England $1.35 and Argentina $3.30 with the line sitting at +7.5. And yeah, I think England are going to be a lot more upset with their loss than Argentina will be inspired to bounce back from their loss. Like, I can see England dropping their bottom lip, coming into this game with not much to really play for, throwing out a completely different team, maybe Marcus Smith at first five and a whole bunch of changes, whereas Argentina are really going to try and gun for this game, and they're really going to do what it takes to win it. So I'm actually going to take the line at +7.5 at $1.92 with Argentina, but I really think they can just win this game head to head, so I'm actually backing them to get this done.
Like, I forget that it's going to be like Creevy's last game, Sanchez's last game at a World Cup as well.
Yeah, a bronze medal means a whole lot more to Argentina than it does in England.
I'm going to hold your hand.
Okay.
Sweet. Argentina.
I was just looking to see what kind of prize money is on offer for the... just to see if it's worth... They don't have a third... I can't see a third place...
Maybe you got to melt down the bronze.
So you basically, you get $1.5 million. So if you make it to the quarterfinal, I don't know if it stacks or not, but I'm just looking at it. But you get $1.5 million if you lose a semi. You get $3 million if you come second, and $6 million. This is all USD from this website here, Sporting Lad, if you take it home. So there probably is some prize money to pay for third place and a bit of pride. I think the better, I will describe this as Argentina looking for one final scalp and to prove that they are a serious international contending team versus England, who are trying to save some face and not lose to another Southern Hemisphere team. And they would probably consider themselves better than Argentina overall as a rugby nation. So
yeah,
they have very different styles. If England do what they did to South Africa and played tight, dominant, and territory-based, Argentina won't be able to take victory from the jaws of defeat like South Africa did. But if England allow Argentina to play with some flair and attack as aggressively as they can do and provide some really solid defense, Argentina could surprise them. But what I do think is that England do end up with this one. It's probably the balance of probabilities. And let me just check my notes really quickly. I've got England... 1-5 at $6.50, 18-15 full-time score.
Nice. Super close. I like how you're narrowing down the margins in this one. You're going for a bit more jam. Now the All Blacks, they take on South Africa in the Rugby World Cup final on Sunday morning at 8 a.m. So, of course, I'll be going for the All Blacks in this one. But both of these teams, if you've watched throughout the Rugby World Cup and noticed on the jerseys, they've got 3 World Cups each. Who's going to push it to 4 in this one? Now, the last 4 times we have played South Africa, we've won 2 each. They've won 2 each. The last 2 Rugby World Cups, we've beaten them whenever we have come up against them. However, South Africa have never lost in a Rugby World Cup final. And the All Blacks, well, the only loss that we had was to South Africa in 1995 in the World Cup final. In 2015 in the semi-final, we won 20-18. Now in 2019, the Springboks, they won the World Cup that year, but we actually beat them in pool play 23-13. Seems like a tough ask to prepare for them at the moment, though, as well. One moment they're playing with their starting 15, 30 minutes later, they'll pull a key driver off and they'll put another one in and completely change tactics. They'll do random kicking. Faf de Klerk might get a turnover and he'll try and kick a 50-22 from his own 30 or something like that. So it's going to be interesting to see how we actually prepare for the Springboks in this one and what game plan we target them and how we adjust at halftime. The All Blacks, though, they've gone on an incredible run since losing to France in this World Cup. Huge victories. They eliminated the number one team in the world in the quarterfinals. We've scored a total of 325 points in this year's Rugby World Cup while only conceding 77. Men that wear the black jersey as well, they've scored a total of 48 tries throughout this competition. Damn. So tries are plenty in this one. The All Blacks, I think they make it 4 Rugby World Cups in this one. Ooh. Up the mighty ABs.
Okay, so you do have the All Blacks as the favourites, $1.72, and South Africa, $2.15 underdogs. with the line at a measly +1.5. And yeah, you pretty much broke down all the stats I was going to bring up. The only thing that is pretty glaring that can split them, because you read off all of that, even as like all the head-to-head stuff at World Cups and in between last World Cup and now is just
it's give and take.
And the only glaring thing that stands out is that South Africa whooped us 35-7 in a World Cup warm-up. But that seems like
it's a warm-up
first and foremost, and it seems like an age ago at this point, considering where the teams have gone in their trajectory throughout the World Cups. All Blacks are definitely the team with more momentum than South Africa at the moment. South Africa laid a complete egg against England, but they also showed some red flags as well, like their ability to take the high ball. Their just errors in general were a little too high for my liking. And when you're taking on a quality attacking outfit that's dangerous from anywhere on the field like the All Blacks, you can put yourself under a lot of pressure. And at the moment, it seems like the All Blacks are kind of just ticking on all cylinders. And that attacking ability, off set piece, off scrums, off lineouts, their kicking game is at its peak right now. They're just the quality team. They're the new best team in the world, and they took that crown off Ireland, and I think it's going to roll through here. I'm backing them. I'm going the All Blacks 1-12 at $2.70. I think we get our fourth World Cup, and we give South Africa their first loss in a final.
Nice. All right. So while I talk, you guys think of an exact score, please. I'm thinking...
okay, Dad.
Yeah. Well, I want to know, and the punters at home want to know what you think this exact score is going to be. But what I'll bring up is that we've heard the officiator for this game is, of course, our friend Wayne Barnes. So that is a bit of who knows what's going to happen there. As long as he keeps his whistle out of his mouth and lets these two teams play against each other, I think we'll have a fantastic game of rugby. If he gets too litigious and starts blowing if he blows lots of penalties, the game will lose its flair, and then we're just going to start kicking penalties, and it will be a tight, intense game, but it's just not the exciting rugby World Cup that we want between two teams who can run the ball fantastically well and can build pressure through phases. So I think if we kick to attack, but what I want to see is that game we played against them at Mount Smart. We attacked around the rucks with a lot of men in motion and a lot of quick passing, and we put players through holes and then found our men on the wingers. So that game at Mount Smart was fantastic by us. So I think if we play a similar style to that, we can really put some points on South Africa. I'm thinking it's going to be close. I'm picking New Zealand 1-12 at $2.60, exact margin of 25-20.
Yeah,
with a few tries each and some penalties. My same game multi based on the odds as they are and the teams aren't announced, but I'm going the New Zealand point starts -4.5, total points over 40.5, Bongi Imbonambi anytime try scorer, Mark Talia anytime try scorer, and Will Jordan first try scorer for $81.
I like how you read the fine print beforehand as well. The teams haven't been announced yet, but this is what I'm going with.
Yeah, well, the thing is those three players have played every game.
Yeah,
they're pretty sure.
I like what you got. Do you want to give a score prediction?
Yeah, score prediction. I was just thinking about it then. I'm going to go 23-19 for the All Blacks. I think the All Blacks are going to go... Oh, great. That's crazy.
I've just written down 23-19 as well.
Yeah, fantastic. So, Look at that. 2-1. That's basically where I'm at. Yeah. And I think the All Blacks are going to go up, say, like 20-6 around halftime. They're going to get the lead, and it's going to be us sweating down the stretch as South Africa claw it back with some, you know, kicking and just eat-ass rugby. So that's where I'm saying the game's going to go.
Nice. What I like about this one as well, we've got the All Blacks, we've got the most capped rugby player in the world, Sam Whitelock, in his last Rugby World Cup. But the likes of Aaron Smith, Bowden Barrett all moving on, Retallick, Cody Taylor, Dane Coles, there's a lot of feeling around this atmosphere. You've got a lot of boys in camp. Richie McCaw's over there, Dan Carter, Kevin Mialamu, Conrad Smith, Stephen Donald. There is a lot happening within that All Black camp and a lot buzzing and waiting on this.
Shout out, Victor Vito was doing team runs with them as well.
Okay.
Yeah, and I seen Kieran Reid was around in France. So
Yeah, I had a message come through on the page and someone asked if Victor Vito was benching for us on the weekend. I was like, I don't think so, mate.
He's a few years. He hadn't picked up his boots for years before they called. In years, he said on the interview before he got called in to do like some opposed training.
He was good in his day, though.
Fantastic. My best bets for this one, again, I'm jumping on Will Jordan to break that all-time Rugby World Cup leading try score record anytime at $2.25 in this one. Captain, or not captain, but is a captain. Superman Adi Savia anytime at $3.50. I've gone for a try bet of either team wins by under 7.5 points at $2.05 in that one as well. Like it. And a little magical multi there as well. I've gone Will Jordan anytime try scorer. The total points to be over 34.5 and the All Blacks head to head at $3.75.
Very nice. Very nice.
Into the NFL. The TAB featured bet this week. We're looking at locking in a couple of quarterbacks on this one for passing over yards in this. So CJ Stroud, over 200 plus passing yards against, I haven't got who they're taking on, but that's from the Texans. Jalen Hurts, over 250 passing yards for the Eagles there, and Patrick Mahomes, he absolutely balled out last weekend. Expect nothing less. 250 plus passing yards in this one for the Chiefs there, and I wouldn't expect any more or less, 150 of those probably to just be to Mr. Swift and Travis Kelce himself.
Well, it was last week.
I know. Player performances that impressed us, though. I'll kick it off, and I'm going Jordan Addison from the Minnesota Vikings. So against the 49ers and the Vikings, 22-17 victory. He scored two touchdowns with 124 yards total and 7-for-10 receptions per target. Simon, I'm not sure if you've been following this Jordan curse that we've been coming across, but he called the 49ers 2 weeks ago to go undefeated in the season.
Yes,
and they've gone back-to-back losses now. Now, in 2023, Addison, he scored a total of 6 touchdowns. Only Tyreek Hill has more than him, and that's 7. I said at the start of the year, keep an eye out on this guy because he's absolutely electric. Justin Jefferson out at the moment, and he's absolutely proving that. What's crazy is that in primetime as well, 3 rookies in Vikings history have had 100-plus receiving yard games. Randy Moss, Justin Jefferson, and now Jordan Addison. Elite company. Not only that, the Vikings, they are also the first team this season to score first against the 49ers. Prior to that, the 49ers have been the first team to score in whatever matchup they've been in. So next year, look for this duo of Jefferson and Addison to absolutely take over the league, because we're seeing this veteran wide receiver partner up with this young gun, and it's just going crazy. But this guy is the real deal.
Yeah, and man, you're calling Justin Jefferson a veteran already? That's crazy.
Yeah, well he's I guess veteran so. Numbers.
Compared to Jordan Addison, and you were right on Jordan Addison. You said him before the start of the season to watch out for this guy, and you sent me some highlights. I was like, oh, damn, that guy is cold. Mm-hmm. And he's proven it on the field. What was he, a first-round draft pick?
He was mid to late, sort of. I think he went maybe 23 or 27 or something like that. So, I mean, when you're looking at a draft, you have your elite wide receivers, elite quarterbacks, and defensive tackles and stuff like that. And then you start to sort of trickle out into what teams need. So they look like they needed another pairing for Jefferson, and fuck, they got one.
Yeah, and that's going to be a good pairing. I'm actually going this week to Lamar Jackson of the Baltimore Ravens, and he was super impressive in their 38-6 domination of the Lions, and the Lions have kind of been rolling lately, so it was a surprise to see them do that on the Lions. Mm. But man, when Lamar's playing like this, you got to expect these things to happen, because he was fantastic. 357 passing yards, 21 of 27 passing on 77.8%, 4 total touchdowns and 37 rush yards. Sensational, man. And a play in this game that really stood out to me was when he kind of, the pocket broke down and he escaped the pocket, and then he ran across to get to open space, and there was a massive hole there that he could have ran and maybe got like a first down and some yardage. But instead of doing that, which is, you know, something he would have done in maybe years prior, where you just run and try to get that first down, he actually stayed there, eyed up his options, and waited for Nelson Aguilar to cut in behind his man, and he found him for a beautiful touchdown in the end zone. So I think we're seeing some growth from Lamar Jackson. His passing has always been pretty good, but it's starting to hit another level this year. 71% completion this season, which is second in the NFL. And I think a lot of that is just coming from his tendencies. Like, instead of being so run heavy, he's kind of relying more on guys like Gus Edwards and Justice Hill to take that load. I forget the other guy who got injured, but you know, you were expecting them to sort of take that load, and that's why they've got all these nice receivers now, because Lamar's got that dart, and he's showing you that he's not just in a bracket as a running quarterback. He is the real deal, and he's probably leading the MVP discussions at the moment.
I agree, and I'm glad that you brought up his growth, because he came into the NFL and was called nothing but a running back.
Yeah.
He was a gun quarterback, and the way that he progressed until his MVP season was fantastic, but the growth that he's taken from that as well. We didn't get to see it so much last year with the injuries and the way it sort of just all went south.
Holding out and stuff.
Exactly, but when you look around the league and you look at the top quarterbacks, you got Patrick Mahomes. First person you think of to go with him is Travis Kelce. Yep. You got Jalen Hurts, you got AJ Brown, you got Josh Allen, you got Stephon Diggs, Tua, and you got Tyreek Hill. Lamar Jackson, doesn't have a lot of elite guys out there. We've got a lot of guys that we're seeing growth from, but not someone that you'd pin your hat on. And for him to just do this kind of consistently at the moment as well is great to see.
Yeah.
Team performance, though, that impressed us. I'm going the Philadelphia Eagles, 31-17 win over the Dolphins. And I wanted to highlight the Calgary Eagles in this one. Miami is a monster on the offensive end, but they held Tua to only 216 yards, which might sound kind of crazy if you listen to this and you just want quarterback on your favorite team to throw over 200 yards. But Tua leads the NFL in passing yards with a total of 2,092 yards. And even in their 48-20 loss against the Bills just a few weeks ago, he threw for 282.
Damn.
So the Eagles did enough to lock up one of the wildest offenses in the league and get the win. And for me, solidify as arguably the top team in the NFL right now. Jalen Hurts, he was a beast in that one. 279 of the best. AJ Brown, 137 of the best. And a touchdown to go along with it. The Commanders, the Cowboys, a bye. And then the Chiefs. Circle that for week 11 because that's going to be an absolute banger.
And that's where I'm going for the team that impressed me this week. I'm going the Kansas City Chiefs, which... is another team with an argument that could be the best team going right now. My 49ers have unfortunately shat the bed and they're out of contention. But the Chiefs are amazing. They beat the Chargers 31-17. Six wins in a row now. And I don't want to mention too much about the whole Taylor Swift situation because it's starting to piss me off now.
Me too, but keep coming.
Yeah, I mean, tone it down a little bit. Just a little bit. I'm sick of like... full coverage after games being about Taylor Swift and the effect that she's having. I'm like, fuck.
He's playing, though.
Yeah, I know. There could be something to that. Maybe she's, you know, giving him some good wrist action. But, you know, Travis Kelce did play mean. 179 yards on 12 receptions and one touchdown. And you mentioned him before, but the boy was back, man. Patrick Mahomes, 424 yards on 76% completion and four touchdowns. You know, they don't seem to have, like, much... out-and-out talent on the offensive ends other than Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce. But they're kind of saying, fuck you, that's all we need.
Mm.
And they're getting wins, six in a row, and they're looking just as good as ever, just as good as they have been going to five conference championships in like the last 5 years, you know? So the Chiefs, man, they just keep rolling. We're in the midst of a dynasty, and they continue to impress.
I don't know if you've noticed in my top five power rankings, I haven't had them in there for quite a while, and it's because of that reason, because it's just the Kelce show with Kelce and Mahomes show, but like, it's a good show to watch. What is crazy as well is Travis Kelce was 100% on reception for targets until late, I think it was in the fourth when he had his first drop, so he was just anything he's picking up.
Is that the one where he's beating the ground?
Yeah.
And
I've seen again, now it's coming up after this performance, the comparison between him and Gronk.
I was going to bring that up in casual corner.
Oh, there we go. I'll leave that for then. The game that we want to feature, though, in the upcoming round, I'm going to go the Texans versus the Panthers. Boring. Maybe considering, but the Panthers haven't won a game this season. It's the number one and the number two picks from this year's draft taking on each other. CJ Stroud will be going into Charlotte to let them know that he should have been the number one pick. Bryce Young, he'll return with that, saying that he is the number one pick. Look for Nico Collins, CJ Stroud to have a big one. We're locking it in for our multi and the TAB feature in that one as well. But these two, it's going to be a fucking interesting show.
Yeah. I forgot that aspect of it. When you brought it up, I knew there was going to be an angle to it. But I forgot that Bryce Young is the guy there for the Panthers. So that is going to be a great game. It's kind of almost an unfair battle with, oh, actually, no, I changed my mind. Panthers got Thielen.
Thielen is the GOAT.
So it will be an even battle between talent. You've got Thielen on one side, and then you've got your, like, Tank Dell, who I believe might be injured, right? Yep. And Collins.
But you've got Nico Collins ready to ball out. And,
Dalton Schultz as well. Like, there's a lot more, there seems to be a lot more talent on the Texans, but still should be a great game between the quarterbacks. And I wouldn't even be surprised, just hearing about his intangibles at Alabama and stuff like that, that he actually gets one over and shows out. So keep your eyes on that game. I've got a game where the stakes are a little bit more grim. You've got the Bengals at the 49ers and two teams that, you know, are title contenders going into the season and have showed that, you know, 49ers were definitely up there.
Mm.
And since I put my curse on them, they've lost two in a row. The Bengals did the opposite. They started the season pretty poor, but are kind of getting some wins together here and there and coming off a bye. So this is really an important game for both teams, for the Bengals, who are 3-3, to string themselves into some positive results and get over 500. And the 49ers are just trying to stay afloat because you've got the Eagles, you've got the Cowboys are still up there on 5-2. Like, they want to keep a stranglehold on that conference.
Yep.
So if they lose here, with a kind of toughish, I know I said it was an easy schedule a few weeks back, but now when you're seeing two easy-ish losses in a row, the games they should have won, the schedule's looking a lot harder because their hard games are still yet to come. So I think this game's going to be important. Bengals at 49ers.
Nice. Top five power rankings. Last week I had the 49ers, the Eagles, the Dolphins, the Bills, and the Lions. It stayed pretty consistent for the last couple of weeks in there, but after last week, I'm ready to shake it all up. The Eagles, the Chiefs, and the 49ers for me are the top three teams in the NFL. I'm going to rank the Eagles at number one, the Chiefs at number two, and the 49ers at number three. The Eagles, they're absolutely fantastic.
Okay.
They're well-balanced over all over the board. The defense really impressed me against the Dolphins. The Chiefs, again, it's the Travis... Well, it's the three-headed monster now. It's the Travis Kelce, the Taylor Swift, and the Patrick Mahomes show. And the 49ers, they've been a little bit disappointing lately. Just trying to find their feet. I wouldn't read into it too much come playoff time, though. And number four, I'm going the Miami Dolphins. It's just a gun offensive team. They can explode at any moment. And the Baltimore Ravens, I'm putting them at number five.
Okay.
I was really impressed. Lamar Jackson, MVP candidate. The defense really impressed me as well. And they've got young guns that are healthy and hungry.
Yeah. So last week I had number one, San Francisco 49ers, Kansas City Chiefs 2, Buffalo Bills 3, Miami Dolphins 4, and Philadelphia Eagles 5. So there has been some big mix-ups this week. So at number five, I've actually got the Jacksonville Jaguars sneaking in at 5-2. I thought, you know, they've won, I think, three games in a row now. So they're actually rolling pretty well. I did really want to put the Miami Dolphins in there instead of them, because if I compare the two losses of the Dolphins, it's Bills and Eagles as opposed to Texans and Chiefs, which Chiefs is, you know, you can forgive them for that loss, but that's demolishing by the Texans is kind of a red flag. But I thought they're the hotter team in hot form, so I'll reward them here. Number four, I got the Baltimore Ravens. Already touched on them. Absolutely fantastic and a great win over a good Detroit Lions team in dominant fashion, so I got them at four. San Francisco 49ers, another loss. I've dropped them down to three. 5-2 they are now, so really alarming signs. They're still a quality team with a whole bunch of talent, and they still got five wins to the season already. So I keep them at three, but you know, I might have cursed them lower down the rankings come next week. And Philadelphia Eagles, I actually have it two.
Yeah,
I've got the Eagles at two. They were super impressive against the Dolphins, 6-1 they are now. But the number one team, Kansas City Chiefs, they did beat the Eagles in the Super Bowl last year. I'm kind of hanging my hat on that, and they just look as impressive as ever. Kansas City Chiefs are my number one team in the power ranking.
Nice. As for touchdown parlays, last week I had Bijan, Cheetah, and Ayuk. Bijan, he didn't touch a ball until the bloody end of the game. Cheetah got one. Ayuk, we went down there. But this week, I'm going to be going Devontae Smith up against the Commanders, Travis Swift Kelce up against the Broncos, and I'm actually going to boost up the odds in that one, and I'm going to go Lamar Jackson up against the Cardinals.
Okay, very nice. Last week I had two out of my three legs hit. I had Travis Kelce and Stephon Diggs go over, but unfortunately Kenneth Walker did not cross for a touchdown. This week I'm going with Tyreek Hill as my anchor. He's taking on the Patriots. I think, you know, he can do a number on that backfield. Isaiah Pacheco, they're at the Broncos, so I say he'll get a touchdown because the Broncos have shown to have a very shaky run defense during times at this season. And Mark Andrews, I like the tight end for the Ravens to get over against the Cardinals. Lamar Jackson's been on fire, and I think he can find him in the end zone for this one.
Nice. Simon, Casual cool. Corner. All right, yeah.
Come on over to Casual Corner, fellas. So you brought it up quickly. An all-time great and one of, or arguably the best tight end the game's ever seen in Rob Gronkowski. Just a couple highlights. Four Super Bowls, four first-team All-Pros, and five Pro Bowls compared to Travis Kelce, who's currently got two Super Bowls, four first-team All-Pros, and three second-team All-Pros and eight Pro Bowls. So similar records. Travis Kelce doesn't seem to be anywhere near the end of his career. And Gronkowski, obviously, he's well and truly done.
Fun fact, Gronkowski and Travis Kelce are the same age.
Wow.
Gronkowski retired really young. Yeah. And I think there was some injury issues involved with that.
Okay, yeah. Well, it was... There was a lot of partying in between all of that as well.
Yeah, the stories of him.
Yeah. I can't quite hang my head on it. Sorry, I'm just trying to find, because I'm glad that you brought this up, because I saw stat comparisons on this earlier through the week. I can't remember them exactly off the top of my head, but Rob Gronkowski played less games than Travis Kelce, scored more touchdowns than him, and he's had more Super Bowl wins than him. So for me, Gronk is better for now, but don't hang your hat on it because Kelce isn't done yet. And for me, I think I love this comparison because you compare Travis Kelce to Rob Gronkowski, but you compare Lamar Jackson, Patrick Mahomes to Tom Brady.
Yeah.
And it's just the same thing that's fucking happening again. And I think both of them are going to eventually surpass these guys.
Okay. Yeah. It's actually really interesting that you bring up the fact that Gronkowski has less games, but more in all of those stats.
Yeah.
And you can easily say, like, well, he had the GOAT throwing to him, Tom Brady, but Travis Kelce does not have a scrub throwing to him. In terms of just pure arm talent, Patrick Mahomes is probably better than Tom Brady, you know? So it's actually hard to say. Those stats that Sam's just brought up has made me second guess because I'm a relatively new fan. I kind of saw Gronk like towards like the back end before he retired. And I've just seen Travis Kelce during this whole run of his prime, and I've been absolutely in awe of what he can do at the tight end position. Brad actually mentioned the other day, said he is the best ball receiver in the whole entire league, regardless of position, including wide receivers, all that. Yep. And by the way he's playing, and from what I've seen over the last couple of years, I tend to agree. So with recency bias, I'm going to give it to Kelce. I am, but after hearing those stats, I'm going to have to put some respect on Gronkowski's name and say maybe he's not there yet.
Quick question. Does Kelce have the sort of just infamous highlights of Gronk just having men just falling off by the wayside and charging through to the touchdown in the end zone? I mean, some of those videos of Gronk with three or four men just hanging off him, just still making meters. It's just, it's inhuman to see a man do that. And to be a big white man in the NFL doing it is crazy.
It's hard to say that Kelce is more finesse because of how big he is and like how he carries as well. But I would say by the way they move, he is more finesse than Gronkowski.
You touched on it before. Kelce is just that little bit more elite, I'd say, than Gronk in terms of his route running. Yep. Gronk could still get up there and make a play, but it's the yards after carry. When Gronk would take that ball and he'd just go downhill and he's got guys carrying, he's carrying guys, he's bumping guys off. Whereas Kelce plays that little bit more conservative in a way. But yeah, I for me, Gronk is still the GOAT, but it's not all said and done yet.
Nah. And we got to remember as well about Gronkowski and his physicality. I'm pretty sure he's like 6 foot six and about 280 pounds. Like he was a monster, man.
And like he's gone away from and then come back and gone away and then come back as well. So
what's Kelce standing at?
I'm not too sure. I think he's slightly shorter.
He would have slimmed down a little bit now as well. For obvious
trying
reasons.
Trying to get some abs going.
Did you have any more questions for Casual Corner?
No, it was just the one,
Nice.
Okay.
UFC 294.
Wow. That's the one way to describe the card from start to finish. Was a shit show.
Bit of a dud. Yeah, bit of a dud card. A lot of weird things happened throughout the card, but, you know, scattered throughout there was still some good finishes and some, there wasn't really much wars that happened during the card, but there was some good fights and some competitive action. But we'll go to the three fights that we covered last week, and we'll start with probably the most controversial of the three, and that was Magomed Ankalaev versus Johnny Walker, ending in a no contest after an illegal knee. Really weird situation.
He's come out and the doctors asked him a couple of questions. And from what I saw, Johnny Walker's come out and answered back. And when he said, "Where are you?" And he said, "The desert."
Yeah. So I'm no psychologist and I'm not going to, well, I am. I am going to do this right now. I'm going to speak on behalf of what I think Johnny Walker was actually thinking. He got kneed in the face and that's on Ankalaev. That was the wrong thing to do. But Johnny Walker, I believe, was purposefully answering those questions a bit suspiciously in hopes that he could earn a DQ from that result. And I believe all the antics after it, where he was like pushing the ref and doing that stuff after the ref had already called off, that was him trying to save face to the audience and act like he is the good guy who wanted to keep fighting, but the ref called it off and stopped him from being able to fight. I think Johnny Walker has tried to get a DQ finish for himself. That's just me. I know he was playing it up and pushing refs and stuff
that,
like
that.
I don't
hate that thinking about it.
And then even after, he's been on Twitter and social media saying, should have been a DQ, and he's been lobbying for DQ, which takes me into his brain of, oh, okay, he was trying to finesse it, you know? Yeah. And he's upset at the result instead of upset at the fight being finished, which he was trying to portray in the cage. So just my take on things.
I was agreeing with you, but then you're talking about him trying to save face and be the good guy. But yeah, what I would say that the antics were, to more your point, is him being angry it wasn't a DQ. and then being like that.
But they didn't announce the DQ until after that whole fracas had happened.
Oh right, okay, then never mind then. Yeah. No, so yeah, it's a weird one. I would he had moments of success though, like you know, he landed a pretty fantastic flying knee of his own, like legally, and that did some serious damage to Anchor Live. So I don't fully understand why he'd want to go for the DQ unless he thought he was a bit compromised.
It's a tough one. Like,
if you give everybody the benefit of the doubt,
I reckon.
He's asking him a question in English. It might not be his first language.
It's not.
There's going to be...
It isn't, but he speaks really good. If you watch all the embeddeds, he makes jokes. He's like really loud, boisterous. So I think that's just my opinion. But I could be wrong.
I'm with you.
It was weird though. Like you watch it back when they're asking him the questions. He does have a bit of a vacant stare going on. Like there is a little bit of damage showing on his face. Like he doesn't look to be all there when the ref is dealing with him. So you need, yeah, I mean. It's hard to see how it'll happen. That ref, suspicious from the get-go. I mean, there was the nut shot with Victor Henry earlier in it where...
Are you talking the doctor or the ref?
The doctor.
Yeah, the doctor.
Which is the one that asked him the question. So the doctor earlier in the night basically told a fighter that he didn't get hit in the nuts.
Yeah, that was way off.
It's weird, really weird. And then he goes in and addresses Johnny and then he has the whole... Because, the ref, all he does is wave off the fight. It's the doctor that tells the ref that he's not fit to continue after the knee. And I don't agree with the decision of the refs to call it an unintentional knee. I think it was incredibly intentional. I think we all know after the publicity of the Aljamain Sterling event that if a fighter is kneeling on the ground, you cannot knee him in the head. Like, there was no movement between the fighters. Johnny Walker was firmly stationary against the cage, and Goliath had kind of, you know, it was over the shoulder, almost behind the back, and just kneed him straight in the face, which is clearly illegal. So I don't agree with the fact that it being called unintentional. I think it was a brain explosion, but it was an intentional knee to the head. Whether he thought it was legal or not, or what he wasn't thinking, it was intentional. He put his knee exactly where it was intended to go. So I think it should have been a DQ.
Should have been a DQ. Yeah, by the letter of the law, it should be a DQ. But do you think they'll run this one back? I think they probably will.
Yeah, I want it to be run back immediately. And you could see that Dana was talking about that immediately in the cage. She's saying, we'll figure this out. And I think that's probably the only way that they'll manage to get it done is for them to run it back quite quickly.
Okay. Moving on to some less controversial matchups. Well, still a little bit of controversy because Hamzat Chimaev defeats Kamaru Usman by a majority decision, which two judges gave it as 2-1 with a 10-8 for Kamaru for Hamzat Chimaev. And then one judge gave the last 2 rounds to Kamaru Usman with the first round being a 10-8. So everyone had 10-8s across the board, but there was speculation over those last 2 rounds because they were really close. Obviously, Hamzat came out and nearly did what we all predicted, and well, you especially with the submissions, he was really trying to go for submissions, took Kamaru Usman down, actually took him down 4 times in this fight, which he had only been taken down once before.
And Simon had come earlier to pick up the microphones before the guys' Twitch session. I'd said to him, I'd just seen the odds on a boosted option for Hamzat Chimaev to take him down 4+ times. Damn. So I jumped on that one. I think it was $5 or $6. So
very nice.
I was stoked with that.
Good look, Simon. Mm. So... yeah, completely dominant first round. A fair 10-8, not a great 10-8. Like, there wasn't a whole lot of damage, but the control and the threatening of the submissions definitely would suggest that that was a 10-8 for Hamzat Chimaev. But then the last 2 rounds are really close, man. Second round, I definitely did give it to Kamaru Usman. I thought he was landing the cleaner shots down the middle.
If it wasn't for the takedown in the final round, I think we were probably leaning towards Usman in that as well. I was super impressed with the stand-up game from Usman. Like you said, the jabbing, just piecing him apart a little bit. Hamzat coming out after the fight and saying that he thought that he'd broke. I'm not sure if it's been updated yet, if he actually did break his wrist or something. But it wasn't the same flair that we sort of got from him, which in those last 2 rounds, which was really surprising for me to watch. Even after the match, he was very respectful, which I guess, whatever. But it wasn't that same Hamzat Chimaev that with the fireworks, the takedowns, the relentless pressure. So it was interesting.
And I thought it was him being a little bit more patient and Because when he fought Gilbert,
what was in front of him.
Because yeah, exactly. When he fought Gilbert Burns, he kind of just went into a war and he was kind of swinging wildly and just engaged in a war. Where I thought maybe that was the case in this one, why he was so reserved. He was trying to be a bit more patient and try to listen to his coaches and not just engage in a war with a very dangerous guy in Kamaru Usman. Mm. But maybe there is something to that broken wrist because, yeah, he definitely slowed down. A lot of people were giving him shit online about his cardio, which he really went out in that first round and tried to finish him by grappling at a very aggressive pace, which is going to make you slow down. But, you know, I think fans are being a little bit too harsh on his cardio. When you do fight like that in the first round, you are bound to slow down. And he was still competitive in the fight. It's not like he slowed down and started fucking wobbling everywhere. Yeah, and
big mouth open.
And he was still going for takedowns as well. He was aware of what was in front of him, especially in that last round. And he knew he had to go and get that takedown, which he went and got. But yeah, it was an interesting fight. I was really hoping for me that had potential to be the fight of the night, just some absolute fireworks to it. But like you said, it is something that I sort of noticed straight away in that second round with Usman in terms of the jab that started to become very evident. And I'd like to, you guys might have a different sort of opinion on this, but I'd like to see that run back again at some point.
Okay. Yeah, well, I mean, if Usman stays at middleweight, it's definitely a possibility because he will be up there. He will be a contender. And I'm sure Hamzat's got his eyes on bigger and better things. But Simon, do you agree with this decision, the majority decision to go Khamzat's way?
I'm not incredibly upset with it, but I'm looking at the scorecards and David Letherby, who's he scored it the 10-8 to Khamzat and then the rounds 2 and 3 to Usman, and that would be my scorecard for the fight. So I would have considered it to be
so you have damage base.
Yeah. But then you've got both the other judges flip flop on round 2 and 3. So both of those judges gave differing rounds to either fighter. So one had round 2 for Usman and round 3 for Chimaev, and the other had it round the other way. So that shows how close it was to being a unanimous, if not majority, draw.
Yeah.
So I do think they need to run it back. Had it been a 5-round fight, I think it would have been a very different conversation. Had it been a full camp lead-in for Usman, I think it would have been a very different conversation. Fantastic fight. Like, it was very enjoyable to watch.
It was good.
And full credit to Usman for putting on such a classic performance.
On 10 days' notice.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not mad about the result. I'd love to see them run it back, but I mean, I think both fighters have bigger and better opportunities at middleweight.
That's exactly where I'm going to go for up next. Well, firstly, I'll just do some stats because it was 38-36 significant strikes to Chimaev, but it was 33-22 significant strikes in the last two rounds to Usman. So that probably leads into what you're saying in terms of being a majority draw, which I'm kind of with Sam. I did think it was Chimaev slightly edged the last round with the takedown, but it's obviously damage-based scoring. Yeah. And if you look at the stats here, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that Usman did get that decision. And maybe they could run it back. They're not.
No.
Not immediately anyway, but maybe somewhere down the line. Chimaev has come out in the rankings at number 9, which is a lot lower than a lot of people probably expected him to enter the rankings.
I thought that was quite fair.
I thought he would be up there with Costa. You know?
Why though? He fought a welterweight.
Yeah, but he also fought the greatest welterweight of like all time, pretty much. I know. So it's a good quality opponent, and you just kind of look at skill for skill, and he's ranked. So this is what I have a huge problem with. He's ranked below Jack Hermanson, who Hermanson's all right, but Hermanson and Chimaev have had a wrestling match before, and I'm pretty sure Chimaev beat him 7-0, which in wrestling is just like a whitewash. It's just like taking him down over and over again. So I would expect them to be higher than Jack Hermanson.
But Hermanson's not just a wrestling guy.
He's a good kickboxer.
Yeah, but I mean, well, when I say wrestling, his specialty would be in the submission game. Like that's what he's not a wrestler. He's a submission artist. So
he's pretty all round. But I get what you're saying. But I just thought that was pretty low. So after seeing that ranking, I think it's going to be hard to sell number 9 versus your world champion.
Yeah, I don't think he gets it.
With the injury as well to the wrist, he's going to need some time out. I think Dricus du Plessis has earned himself his title shot finally. I think he's going to finally get it.
Mm. Yeah, I don't see any other opportunity for somebody else unless they decide to give it to Rob. But Rob just got dropped by him, so they won't.
Can't do that.
Yeah, so I've got some names here. If Usman stays in middleweight, I want him to see the guy that pulled out of the card, which was Nassourdine Imabov. I think that would be a nice scrap. He deserves, he needs a fight soon. And a lot of the middleweight division have fights already. That's the issue. A lot of those guys in that bracket, for Usman to take another shot from, you know, nine down, they're all busy. So I think Nassourdine Imavov would be a great entry point for him to get a good win and then start taking names above that in the rankings. But then I think comes out, takes on Rob. I want to see it.
Okay, yeah. From a fan's perspective, that is a great matchup.
Yeah, I definitely
do want to see that. Was there anything you wanted to see from Usman in particular? Or?
Nah, I'm not sort of in tune with it all. When I did say that I'd like to see them run it back, I didn't mean straight away.
Yeah.
It's at some point, when you think about the legacy that Usman has in terms of the takedown defense, as opposed to Chimaev, who is just this rocket that just wants to take down anything down, and the flair that comes with it. I agree with Simon. I would like to see five rounds and see how he does prepare for it.
Yes, exactly. Maybe with a belt on the line. Yeah. So you want to see Usman stay at middleweight was pretty much
I do, to be honest. Okay. And in terms of like legacy and things like that, is again, like when you've got a guy who's absolutely dominated his division, just go up and look for something new as well. We've seen it with, you're going to touch on Volk again shortly as well, but it makes it a little bit more interesting as well. These guys jumping out and trying stuff that's
opens
new.
Up the opportunities, opens up the potential opponents that you can take on. So it might be the career move, especially as he gets older. He probably doesn't want
to have to cut like that as well, especially still, at that age. So.
Bro, he still came in looking huge, man. He still looked shredded as hell. So. Yeah, you probably don't want to be going back down after getting a taste of an easy weight cut. You're probably, hey, this was all right. I've cut like the weight in one day. So let's stay here.
Welterweight looks scary for Usman as well.
Yeah, and I guarantee they'll give him someone like a Shavkat as well if he goes back down.
Yeah.
Which that man is a beast. But we'll go to the main event now. And a sad result. Mm. Unfortunately, I picked it. But Islam Makhachev defeated Alex Volkanovski by round one TKO via head kick, 3 minutes and 6 seconds into the first round. No, I didn't pick it that quick. Like a first round TKO, it was pretty sad to see a very dominant victory by Islam Makhachev. Volk was doing all right. He was, you know, reversing clinch positions with the double underhooks, turned him on the cage. Islam Makhachev was impressing me with his control in the Thai plum, though. Like he was really strong in that position, and there were some dodgy moments where he was bringing the knee up and I was saying, oh, those are getting close, Volk, let's be a bit careful here. But nope, ultimately a head kick, one of Volk's weaknesses. We've seen it in other fights. Max Holloway dropped him with a head kick. Yair Rodriguez was giving him scary moments with head kicks. Makhachev in the first fight was landing head kicks, and we saw it here, finally got over a not even a clean one. I was going to say a clean one, but it actually brushed off the guard.
Yeah.
And it was just great follow through. Hit the top of the head, kind of wrapped around the back of the head a little bit. Had him all sorts of hurt. No problem with the stoppage. He went down and it was a bit of back of the head shots.
Yeah.
Back of the head shots leading to the finish. But, you know, you look at his eyes and you look at, you know, Makhachev's knee under his head and the way he was like bobbling his head.
There was no tension. Yeah.
He was done. It was a clean knockout. Sad to see. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to apologize to everybody listening. I let my heart get in the way of this one and tried to pick Volk. I thought he could, you know, I wanted to believe he could get it done. And you know, it was definitely an insurmountable task for him to go out there and get that done. But for Islam to win in that sort of dominant fashion shows credit that he is a fantastic fighter. I mean, to invest in leg kicks and body kicks so early and then to go, you know, to straight into a head kick and land halfway through the first round, that's an incredible short distance between like setting the trap and exploiting it, which was it's impressive to see that happen. Back of the head shots. I mean, when it's that finishing sequence and you can see the writing on the wall, I'm not too upset with it. It's more about if it's the one strike that leads to the finish, if it's on the back of the head, that's worrisome. I mean, you want all the shots to be clean,
but it's a dangerous shot, though.
Yeah, it is dangerous.
Unprotected to the back of the head.
Yeah, you don't want people to get seriously damaged from back of the head strikes, but you want fights to end quickly once somebody's that compromised. You don't want it to see it drag on unless you see an opportunity for them to reverse position and fight their way out of it. Like, what's a good example? Oh, I can't think of one at the moment. But yeah, so I mean, there was no way Volk was going to turn that around and stay in that fight.
He was done.
He was done. And it's a bit sad, but also really nice to see the moments afterwards of him speaking honestly about why he took the fight and the troubles he's had with being inactive, recovering from surgery and waiting for this opportunity to fight at featherweight again. So
It was really interesting seeing him like bring his walls down and showing the vulnerability like that, because he has always portrayed himself to the media anyway as a strong as fuck, like hard-nosed man that can't wilter with his with anything. But he really showed something very real then, and you know, it's a credit, because that sort of stuff does need to be talked on, but also like a kind of like, wow, I didn't think you actually had that. I mean, it will be inspirational to a lot of people that do deal with things like that. So shout out to Volk for actually bringing that to his attention. But Sam, were you, what are your thoughts on the fight? Were you disappointed? Were you surprised?
Look, I was surprised in the way that it ended. I think if it wasn't going to be Volk that got that victory, I thought it would have been a grinded out sort of affair and Islam would have got the submission on him just due to the preparation that sort of came across to it. I didn't think it was going to be fireworks like that in round one. As for the fight itself, I'm glad that it sort of, we got to see them run it back again, but I think it was a bit unfortunate in the circumstances. Yeah. Had Volk actually had the correct time to prepare for the mammoth that it was to actually take it to him and do, just do what we were all hoping that he was going to do. I think that is the only shame in this, and the fact that we might not actually see it happen again. Yeah. That's the only thing that's sort of leaving me a little bit like, full credit to you, but man.
Yeah, the thing is,
Yes, I was just going to piggyback off that and say that the questions weren't completely answered.
And I think there is still, there's still the question, because I think that he could have done it.
Yeah.
I'll offer a counterpoint and say, you know, he could have had a massive lead in camp. He could have done all the preparation right and he still could have got head kicked KO'd like he did. But right. I think the way that he won, you know, if it had been a grind out decision and we see his gas tank falter, or we see, you know, that there's some technique preparation that Volk hadn't made, but the fact that he got KO'd in the first round from a head kick just kind of shows the fact of, you know, like maybe
the levels.
And through all of this, like sort of being a little bit upset at Volkanovski's loss, a lot of credit has to go to Islam Makhachev, because he showed that his striking is at a very, very high level, and he has the power to knock out a strong guy like Volkanovski. And I was going to ask you guys a question before we move on to what's next for these guys. You've got the protege, Islam Makhachev. You've got Khabib Nurmagomedov, who went 29-0, undefeated in the UFC and in professional fighters in general. A lot of them before were considered cans. But who do you guys think is better skill for skill between those guys, Khabib and Islam Makhachev? Because we got to start having this conversation now with Islam Makhachev looking good in so many aspects of mixed martial arts.
I can't comment on it too in depth. Yeah. So I'll go first before we get into you. But I think you're going to have to lead towards Islam at the moment, just because... I don't know. It's a fucking, it's a tough question, eh? Like, he's not said and done, whereas Khabib is. But in terms of just the range and what he's done in the fights that he's finished, the opponents that he's come up against as well, I would say I'm leaning towards Islam at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the couple of things that are leading towards Khabib just being fantastic, this is in my own personal opinion as a UFC fan, is I've never really seen highlights of Islam talking shit to people in the cage going, huh, let's talk now. I'm coming to smash your boy. You know, like the fact that when he was beating people, he was demoralizing them at the same time, you know, he doesn't have the same striking capabilities as Islam. Like, we've seen Islam stand up, be incredible, and drop people like Oliveira, Volk, and all these other fighters. But Khabib, once he entered that zone and got you into his area, he was, you know, he would have you until the end of the round or the fight would be over. Like, that was what happened when you were in the fight with Khabib. And that kind of dominance is why he was undefeated. So in terms of well-roundedness, and you add in the ability of striking on the feet, which is much more enjoyable to watch. You know, like, I enjoy watching Islam fight compared to the way Khabib fights or fought. So, yeah, if you're looking at the comparison, you'd say Islam overall, but in terms of the pure wrestling aspect and the dominance and the violence on the floor, I'd give that to Khabib.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with both your points, actually. You've pretty much hit the nail on the head. In a vacuum, skill for skill, I think Islam Makhachev is better. He's just a much better stand-up striker anyway. With, you know, Khabib, He had a decent-ish jab, but he was real dodgy. Kind of like, he didn't move very naturally as a striker. But when the grappling got to the floor, he was on another level. And he did have something mentally that I haven't quite seen from Islam yet in terms of like just that dog and that ferocity. Willingness to like hurt opponent, to smash guys. So it would be a tough one. I do always believe in the natural progression of a sport. And although he might not be better and may not have that dog now and may never have that dog, I do think there will be a point in time where Islam just keeps improving under the tutelage of Khabib Nurmagomedov, keeps defending his title because it's hard to see anyone that can beat him on the horizon at the moment, and keeps adding to his legacy. And I think he will be better than Khabib Nurmagomedov at the moment. I mean, in the future, sorry. But in terms of a fight right now, fuck, man, I think Khabib, maybe, oh, I don't know, it's tough.
Yeah, well,
Khabib was fucking good, man.
The natural progression, like you talk about, Khabib entered the UFC in an era where it was jiu-jitsu and striking, and the kind of dominant position control wrestling that the Dagestanis are good at wasn't as prominent. So the defense against the positions that Khabib maintained and applied, power through, wasn't as well known and well defended. But now when Islam's there, they've seen all the footage from Khabib. They know these positions, and there are some game plans in place which Islam now has to overcome. Yeah. So there is that progression aspect, and maybe Islam is a better wrestler than Khabib. He's just coming up against better defense that makes him not look as dominant.
Very good point. Valid point. In terms of what's next for Islam now that he's defended his title, What do you see from him? There's really just two options.
I want to see Oliveira. I mean, I know that there was the cut and everything. I just want it's sad that Volk got KO'd so quickly, but it's fantastic in terms of reworking that rematch as soon as possible. Islam didn't take much damage. Oliveira can heal up a cut and continue to fight, prepare for the fight. So I want to see that as early as possible next year.
And I think that's the direction they're going to take, because Dana even alluded to it in the post-fight press conference. But I would like to see something different. And Islam has spoken on his legacy and wanting to fight new names. So I wouldn't mind him taking on Justin Gaethje. I don't think they're going to go in that direction. But I wouldn't mind bad BMF title holder versus lightweight world title holder. Have them go up against each other. And yeah, I don't like Gaethje's chances, but I reckon just a fresh matchup to, you know, get away from this Oliveira, Volkanovski, Oliveira trend that we're seeing at the moment. So that's what I'd do for him. In terms of Volkanovski, do you want him to see fight Topuria in January, like he's been saying he wants to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those cuts on his face were pretty nasty. He had one on both eyebrows.
Should be all right.
They should be all right. They've got pretty good doctors over there. But yeah, I don't really see any other option. I don't think he should go down the rankings in lightweight. I just think he should stay there at the top of featherweight and just assert the dominance, because there are some contenders rising up, and Topuria is the top of that category and is quite deadly. I mean, we've seen him do some damage on the people that are floating around with Emmett, Yair and stuff like that. So I think Topuria deserves a shot. Okay. I don't think we need to wait.
Yeah, no, I agree. There is a little concern because he got knocked out, and pretty badly knocked out, that maybe he should take a little bit more time and stretch it out further than January. But, you know, I think Volks should be all right. He seemed very coherent. He even did a post-fight press conference. So I think he's all right. And I think he should be able to turn around for January and give his best effort and be in a full training camp where he can, you know, get back down to 145 weight, get his fitness up, hopefully recover that chin and, you know, give it his full effort, because Topuria is no joke, man. No, and there's going to be a lot of people who have seen this result and are going to be taking Topuria a lot more seriously as a chance to beat Volkanovski. Yep. So impressive stuff to come in the future. Volkanovski to fight, Makhachev to fight. We've got a massive card coming in a couple of weeks with some big news in terms of John Jones being pulled out. Yeah, did you see that stuff?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
very interesting. They've now replaced that with Tom Aspinall versus Sergey Pavlovich, which this may not be, you know, what everyone else probably thinks, but to me, this is more of an exciting fight.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. These guys aren't geriatric at all. I mean, to take the words, that's what Chael Sonnen said. He said, to think that people are still going to be interested in those geriatrics and believe that it's for the belt when they run it back, like, it's just laughable. And it's so true. Now that we've got the true, like, number one and two for the heavyweight division, which is Plavovic and Aspinall. As soon as we see them fight, it's not really going to be interesting. And I don't... Do we see John Jones at all after this? Because he wanted to fight Miocic.
And yeah.
Has anyone...
He might have to give the belt up.
Has either of you torn a pec before?
No, I haven't.
Or know the time span of a torn pec?
Yeah, I think maybe the only thing that I could sort of compare it to would maybe be like a bicep or something like that, just in terms of the contraction motion. And if something came with it as well...
They said he tore off the bone.
Well, there you go. So we're looking at potential surgery from that. Yeah, and
that sounds pretty bad.
Just on it, I did see someone post a screenshot on Twitter from a Google search around the commonness of upper body ligament injuries and the correlation to anabolic androgenic steroid users. Apparently it's quite common.
Damn, heavyweight John Jones, taking this fight super seriously, maybe too seriously.
Yeah, potentially.
Oh, okay. So very interesting stuff. Good UFC on the horizon and looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, well, but none this week.
Yeah, none this week, unfortunately. So have a week off. Enjoy your Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
Get out of the house.
Well, I mean, you're going to be watching the All Blacks, right?
So, No, stay in the house.
Well, yeah, that's another one in the books for us. So we'll be here to review everything and preview the international footy final for the rugby league as well. But enjoy that one and we'll see you again next week.